Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Dow is up. The NASDAQ is down. Small caps get hurt even worse this week. The worry is about whether or not China is really going to have a major inflationary problem. And this week coming, we have President Obama giving his State of the Union speech across all sorts of social media, live on YouTube and more. We'll get to all this and our guest, Tim Seymour, as we begin episode number 196 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hi there. It's Andrew Horowitz, and welcome to this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the end part of January 2011. We have a good deal to talk about because a lot of stuff happening in the markets, whether it's earnings, whether it's China, cloud computing, and I have some things that I want to talk to you about what we're looking at as some themes for 2011. So let's start with, we do have Tim Seymour that's going to come up in a few minutes, and he is with Emerging Money. You may have seen him on, of course, CNBC's afternoon market wrap, if you will, at 5 o'clock in the evening. Fast Money. He's one of the regulars on that show, and I think we'll have a lot to talk about. I've spoken to him many times about emerging markets, and if there's one person you really want to go to, this is the guy. He knows about the emerging markets and all about what's happening with many of the individual companies. I wanted to start out this discussion today with what's gone on in the markets last week, because it was kind of a tale of many stories, maybe many cities, many markets, in that we had the fears over China's inflation clearly showing a major GDP advance last quarter, much greater than was expected. I think it was about 9.8, I think, was the actual number. And the print was about almost 1% higher than was expected, even though inflation popped down ever so slightly down to the 4.6 from the 5.1 month over month from last month on a year-over-year basis. The fact is that there's a lot of concern that China is going to slow down in their overall buying of materials. We saw many of the materials just crater this week. And on top of that, they're wondering what's going to happen if China actually slows their economy. How is that going to affect the rest of the world? This really was the focus of the beginning of the week and the concern that spread throughout the world on that matter. And then, of course, we had the early parts of the week, the really big concern about the European matter. And then all of a sudden, the end of the week, the euro just starts rising and rising. It almost looked like it was something more than just the German confidence that came out at the end of the week. And it was something more than just the Portuguese and Spanish bond auctions of the week prior that were good. It was much more like a carry trade being played out, where you would take a loan or borrow against or sell off a particular currency, let's say, and buy some other currency that has a higher potential for growth. And in this case, particularly on Friday, as we watched the market unfold, it seemed that every single time the market wanted to go down last Friday, the euro would start rising a bit and would hold the bottom level of the market up. So it was like there was a big trader out there, or traders in unison, looking at a carry trade because the economy in the United States had been getting much better. At the same time, they realized that some of the European situation may be behind them, or at least they thought so. So that's what happened. The euro actually went up above 136 for the week, up about, I think at the end of the week, it was about 2.5% for the week. Pretty amazing stuff for a currency after seeing it down about 2% the week before. We also had the market showing some different signs, a lot of divergences going on. For example, we saw the Dow Jones was actually up on the week. Now, that's only 30 stocks, as you know, but it was up on the week by about 0.8%. And when you look at the internals of that, what happened was, of course, you had IBM that helped it, which was a great quarter, and investors actually cheered them on. At the end of the week, you had a major move by General Electric, GE, that came in better than expected. And, of course, they were talking a pretty rosy picture. And that actually helped the stock up by 7% on Friday alone. It's at about a two-year high now, GE. Still far off from its high, but about a two-year high. So that's what kind of started and started to, you know, move the markets at the beginning of the week. But the big issue here that I want to explain is that while we had these big companies doing very well, the Apples, the IBMs, GE, and throughout the week, small caps just got obliterated. The Russell 2000 index was actually down about 5.5% during a shortened week, right? We only had 4 days this week. And that was pretty amazing. The NASDAQ was about down 2.5%. Now, of course, we mentioned that some of this started early in the week, but the NASDAQ, the techs, the small caps never were able to catch up. I'll give you a couple examples why. Now, look at Apple, what happened. Apple came out with great earnings. Apple was looking like it was going to start hitting an all-time high. Apple was really doing very well. And all of a sudden, we mixed the, of course, realization that we heard a few days prior that Steve Jobs was going to be taking a medical leave. And all of a sudden, there's some head scratching going on and saying, you know, what's going to happen moving forward? Almost an identical circumstance happened at the end of the week where Google announced that while they had great earnings, they're going to be having a management reshuffling. So Eric Schmidt, who's been running the company since it really went public and really brought the company beyond just a techie kind of boutique to the next level that was a business and was making billions and billions of dollars of earnings on a regular basis quarterly, is going to be moving to, they're moving him down, or maybe not down, but they're moving him to a different post. And all of a sudden, it's going to be run by one of the original developers and co-founders of Google. Now, what was also a little bit of a head scratcher was that the day that Google made that announcement, that Eric Schmidt put out a notice to sell about $300 million worth of his stock. So that was about, I think, 6 or 7% of his total stock in Google. Now he's selling. So when investors start seeing that a manager is moving and maybe taking out of a particular area, or maybe retiring, or at least being reshuffled, and at the same time, they divest of a major amount of stocks that they own, a major amount of the stock of the company that they own, that they're working for, you have to wonder what that's all about, particularly the timing when it comes to doing it virtually the same day. So you have Apple with the medical situation that really is people are really worried about. You have Google changing around what's going on in their management structure. IBM is just coasting along, doing great. And then we had the real bummer of the week. We had F5 Networks, a darling of the cloud computer space, the really one of the, I would say one of the 5 or 6 beautiful stocks in terms of long-term performance, good management, good fundamentals, good charts. They come out with a number that beats on estimates, but their outlook is not only poor and under what they anticipated in the last discussion and the last update, but more so, they said that their pipe flow, the pipeline, and the flow for their job, if you will, in sales and installations, and is very much slowing. There's a lot of people putting things off again, they said. Now, that's interesting because at the same time, IBM, on a service side of the computer business, comes out with a fact that they're seeing great demand for their services. So I don't think there's actually a competition situation going on there. No, I'm just comparing the two for a minute and saying that there's something going on, whether it's unique to F5 and their product and the areas that they're working and why something is happening, why there's a postponement of deals going through, or is this something that we have to kind of take notice of? This is, you know, don't forget the tip of the iceberg a few years ago was when companies started to slow down and postpone their spending habits. And then people did it, and then the whole thing collapsed. Now, I'm not suggesting that's happening, but I'm saying, you know, you have to keep aware of what is happening, why is it happening, how widespread is the delay of projects that is going on, because don't forget, that trickles down to all sides of the economy. Now, what happened was that F5 tumbled about 25%. I mean, just a major sell-off, never recovered. But that also hurt many of the virtual and cloud computer companies out there. One of our holdings is Acme Packet. I think we talked to you about that. We really like that stock, but that was hit, even though it's in a totally different area. But that was hit by about 7% that day. And we actually added to that position slightly. Then we took off a little bit of that when it started moving down against us again. And we still hold a very small, I don't know, like a 1% position or so of Acme Packet. And we will move back into that if actually the stock does behave, if you will. But you look at the stocks in that whole area, like a Riverbed. You look at even a Salesforce, a Rackspace, even though that Rackspace came back a little bit. Look at Amazon. I mean, they're all rolling over pretty hard and took a real big beating. If you look at that whole space, you really have to wonder what is going to happen, if another one of the earnings comes in and has a similar tone to it. I would say that it would be hard to believe that that's the case. It just doesn't feel that way right now from what you can see here peripherally, anecdotally, as well as everything that we've heard from the last few quarters. It would be pretty sudden and pretty interesting if all of a sudden we saw that, you know, we have a situation where everybody just slows down at the same time, just out of nowhere. I mean, that would be not only interesting, it would be pretty hard to believe. The other thing I want to mention to you that I think you should pay attention to, and we wrote about this for our clients on our Horowitz Company TDIMG private website that we do. You know, we do a weekly update. We do a daily update. We tell everybody what's going on because we really like to have this transparency where everybody understands what the thinking is, why we're doing what we're doing, what's happening, a little bit about the stocks and the portfolio. So all of our clients get that utilize the TDIMG strategy, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. And one of the things we wrote about this week was the upcoming Tuesday night State of the Union address by President Obama. Now, why would we write about this? I mean, what's going to happen there? What's going to be so important with that, right? Well, what's going to be so important with that is that we're going to see a very interesting and probably, I would think this is probably the most incredible amount of live streaming, social networking opportunity that a president has ever had, even compared to what President Obama has done in the past. For example, you're going to have the opportunity to see the live State of the Union address on your iPhone. There's a White House iPhone application. Of course, the White House blog will be blogging all the information that's going on. Now, you can also see, of course, on regular television. You can go to YouTube, you can go to Facebook and other sites, and you can actually see the live presentation of the State of the Union address. So you can see it anywhere you want. I mean, again, whether it's on your computer, on your TV, whether you're on Facebook. I mean, you're not going to actually be able to get away with it, it looks like, away from it. Then it's also going to be, there's going to be some Twitter activity and other things. Let me tell you some other things that are going on. On Thursday, January 27th at 2:30, President Obama will answer questions in a live YouTube interview from the White House. Now, last year, about 70,000 votes were cast on questions received. And what happens is you can actually go to youtube.com/askobama and you can ask questions. There's a whole really, really, really neat interview section there. And you could actually video yourself and send it off. And who knows, I guess they replay that. And you can put a text or video question in either one. But that's kind of neat. And in addition to that, there'll be discussions from the White House experts about issues addressed in the speech through a roundtable that's going to happen live on Thursday, January 27th. Now, here's how it works. This is really what's interesting. You could submit questions during the events, and there's four different ones I'll tell you about in a second, through Facebook at facebook.com/White House. And there's also, you could do it at thewhitehouse.com and a few other places too. Now, Austin Goolsbee, the chairman of Council of Economic Advisors, will be talking that day at 11:30 Eastern. Dennis McDonough, deputy national security advisor at 1 o'clock. Secretary Arne Duncan, deputy Department of Education. Secretary Kathleen Sebelius at she's the Department of Health and Human Services at 4:30. So throughout the whole day, there's going to be all this talk going on and Twittering going on. You can follow them on Twitter, on Facebook, etc. through on Tuesday, and they're going to stretch it out into Thursday, making it kind of like a gigantic week-long open house. You want to call it town meeting, but it's really going to be kind of a flurry, if not an outright snowstorm of information that's going to be flowing. And, when you look at the recent upsurge in President Obama's popularity since he made the speech, I guess it was 2 weeks ago in Arizona. I mean, just an amazing turnaround for him. So whether you like him or not, I think it's really interesting to take a look at all the just remarkable and amazing ability we have now to transfer information and to get information, whether it's immediate or on a replay. I mean, the old days, you had to watch it then and there. Now you can kind of watch TV and the State of the Union address, and you could even just tape it, watch it at a later date, or have it just on YouTube on the go, or who knows? I mean, it's really kind of amazing that you don't have to be there and just sit and watch it. And what I think is the most important is we can now fast forward it for areas we don't like that clapping. I mean, you get to just fast forward and just go through all the horrible clapping. Now, not that it's not deserved, but boy, oh boy, it just gets annoying after a while. I want to hear the speech. I'm sick of the clapping. But the other thing that I think was really shocking, frankly shocking, that happened recently was the appointment of Jeff Immelt to, he's going to be the new White House jobs panel and chairman, and involved in looking for finding ways to grow the private sector jobs. Now, there's been a lot of talk about this, about the real bashing that he did on Obama over the last, year or so. Now, this is after GE, don't forget, GE took about $80 billion from TARP. But there was a great point on the newswires that said that interesting to hear that GEO CEO Jeff Immelt will chair a new White House jobs panel. He runs a big company, but Immelt has shown more skill at cutting jobs, frankly, than creating it. GE finished 2009 with 18,000 fewer U.S. workers than it had at the end of 2008, and U.S. headcount is down 31,000 since Immelt's first year in 2002. During his tenure, GE workers based in the U.S. as a percentage of total employees had fallen to 44% from 52%. So I thought that was a real interesting situation where we had first GE biting the hand that feeds it from the perspective of him, Jeff Immelt, really putting down Obama over the last number of months in a variety of different contexts. And then at the same time, President Obama appointing a very staunch, and well-respected, generally well-respected businessman to a position in the White House, and it clearly is looking like that. Well, let's hold that for a second, because also if we add on top of the fact that not only do we have Jeff Immelt there, but we have William DeLay, and he is clearly, as chief of staff, going to be a majorly pro-business position change. Now, the question here that I was getting to was, you have to ask this. Is President Obama shifting to the right as he saw that the severe Democratic losses in the midterm election, or has he become aware that there's a need for, I have to use the term, a kinder, gentler stance when it comes to business? I don't know if we're going to know or not on Tuesday. I really don't. But this is something that we really should be looking for. Because whether or not on the conservative side, the discussion is that President Obama is just doing this because he realizes what he needs to do to step up his campaign for 2012, or if it is simply going to be a real move, realization that this is something that actually needs to be done. Whatever you want to say, we got a tax break. We're getting a lot more incentives for business, like the Social Security is cut. We're getting a lot more things flushed through the system, much better than we anticipated. You have to believe that. You have to think about that for a second, right? What did we expect? We expected a tax cut to roll over and expire, the Bush tax cuts. We did not even think about, really on the table at least, was not a Social Security tax cut. We didn't have the thought that the administration would go out and bring in such pro and pro-business leaders into the fold. So however, whatever's happening, we have to look at what Wall Street will say and what Wall Street will think. And I don't know, it seems like it's at least not detrimental to anything that I could think of. Obviously, there's other things outside of this that we have to be aware of, like the municipal bond default issue, like the China inflation and India inflation issue, like the obvious earnings issue and whether or not companies are starting to, scale back a little bit after some major spending. So I think that's something that, we have to balance there. But I think the recognition is that there is at least something going on right now when it comes to the understanding by the administration. Now, that's not Don't take that as a bullish or bearish sentiment. It's not. I'm just talking about the political environment and the potential for long-term economics when we look at that together. Okay, so kind of put that to bed for a minute. I also wanted to mention about, you know, I mentioned this is show number 196. Well, show 200 is coming up shortly, and I thought what we would do, because it was so well received last time, was to have another call-in show. Now, this is how we're going to do it. It's pretty easy. And I encourage you, by the way, that if you're a listener, you know, call in. I'd love to hear your questions, whether it's on a stock, an ETF, whether it's about the economy, whether about your personal financial situation, whatever you have in mind, just a question you have about how do you short stocks or, you know, what options to use, what's the VIX, you know, what's the importance of this or that economic indicator, whatever it may be. I want you to call in because the more the better here. So you're probably thinking, well, a lot of people are going to call. I'm not going to call. You know what? Don't think that. I want you to call. I want you to ask a question, just, you know, and it will be a lot of fun. Here's what I want you to do. It's very simple. I want you to send an email to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Put a quick note with your name, your telephone number, and your question, or at least a topic. And what we're going to do is we're going to arrange these, because the way the studio works, to have you, we're going to call you, you know, about the time when the show's going to be on. And we're going to get all these things online, so we have this really great call-in show that can happen. We can line up all the calls and get it all done, so it works and it's very well organized, okay? So simply write askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, put your name, your phone number, and your topic that you want to talk about, or the question. So we can kind of, again, go through these and get those set up. And I really do encourage you, and if you know anybody that has any financial questions, give them the opportunity to do so. Tell them to write in. Okay, now, another thing I wanted to get to here. Let me get to this, because I mentioned this at the top of the show, that there are some general themes that we are watching. We just put out our economic commentary and review. This is a document that we, or a paper that we put out, a research report that we put out once a quarter for our clients. And we've in the past provided some excerpts of this for the blog, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You know, we talk about it because, of course, these are themes that we talk about readily. One of the things we talk about this quarter, for example, is how well retail has done in the face of high unemployment around the developing world. In fact, we were really surprised when we recently saw that the Bloomberg Fashion Index, that part of it is things like high-end retailers like Burberry, Hermes, Louis Vuitton, for example. It's in an all-time high. Now stop and think about that for a second. It's at an all-time high. Would you have thought that before I told you that? Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing that, you know, we find that many of the sales in that area coming from clearly emerging markets, China, et cetera, Asia. And that's really cool because obviously there's money to be spent. While some of the developing nations may have been holding back on extreme purchases of late, it seems that the rest of the world, ex-developing countries in Latin America and in Asia, are spending just fine. And that's really great. And that's why we're so bullish on the emerging markets, generally speaking, on a long-term basis. And that's why we're going to have Tim Seymour here in a minute, as a matter of fact. But I want to talk about some general themes to watch or that we're watching throughout the year. And you're going to hear me talk about these on and off over time because, you know, the bottom line is that, you know, we want to have a, you know, a discussion about some of the things that we're thinking about as generating some opportunities for investments, right? Isn't that what this is all about? So let's start with this. Let's start with biotechnology. So it's clear we know from Harry Dent, from studies, from the Census Bureau, et cetera, that with an aging population in the developing markets, there is an ever-growing need for new drugs. New drugs for whatever is the ailment. Cancer, heart, osteoporosis, whether it's diseases that are genetically based, whether it is you know, something due to just you know, helping the aging process, etc. There are millions of people that will be able to use whatever it is when it comes about. Now, again, we're getting closer and closer. The United States is the leader in the area of biotechnology and medicine. We know that. We also know that diabetes is up and showing incredible signs of growth in emerging markets, in particular in India. We also have the growth of the middle class in those countries, and that's showing a changing diet, changing health. Unfortunately, it's much more of a westernized health. And that's going to be something that we want to look into. Where can we look to invest into, really find opportunity when it is, dealing with these subjects. We also know, number two, the higher interest and mortgage rates, money may begin moving away from bonds. And we saw the beginning of this in December and into January. So we have to watch the long end of the curve because that's getting beat up pretty badly. Whether you hedge it if you're holding bonds, you move out of it, or you simply short the long end, we think it's going to be an interesting play moving into 2011. Now also, 9% or so is probably the new normal for unemployment. Yeah, of course, Pimpo's been talking about this for a long time. They've been saying the new normal and the rate of unemployment in the United States. We seem to believe it. We've talked about this before, and something that we think is going to continue. The rise of the machines, the use of technology that is offsetting the need for the human factor. Offshoring, we talked about that a second ago with GE, but offshoring of workers. Margin squeeze on companies as they see the input costs rising dramatically. One of the things they're going to cut and probably do it quickly is the continuation of not bringing on more employees. And of course, that all boils down to one thing, which is the corporate EPS focus that is always quarter by quarter by quarter. Companies will continue to try to meet or beat analyst expectations, or else we know what happens to their stock. And those managers that are compensated in stock or that are, compensated by the value of the stock want to make sure that holds. We also want to watch carefully how the Social Security tax benefits flow into the economy. Are they going to savings? Watch the savings rate. Are they going to the consumer? If they go to the consumer, is it going to retail? What retail? What areas are they buying? That money is going to flow down somewhere. And right now, the way we perceive it, it will be to consumers spending money rather than saving money. Now, number five, we think that is going to be something we want to watch is the pot. Now, these are not surprises. These are things that we're looking at right now that we think will continue to be the focus. Is the possible rotation of investments. We've been seeing this. Out of bonds, out of growth, out of materials, out of energy, and into value, healthcare, financials, et cetera. We saw this in December again. We saw that there was this rotation out of some of the go-go technology and into the banks. Now, maybe they did that a little prematurely from what we saw with the Bank of America and a few other, like the Goldman Sachs earnings last week. Although JP Morgan was good, SunTrust was good. But, when you look at the rotation that's happening, it clearly looks like that there is this rotation of profit-taking of the better sectors into the worst sectors of last year. Now, that may not go on much past January, especially if we see that earnings are not solid for the losing area. But realize that when we look at the transmission of, the rotational aspect of this particular cycle right now, it clearly is very apparent from the winners to the losers. Kind of like a dogs of the Dow approach. Number six, we want to look at housing prices going forward. We have seen since August that the Case-Shiller index is down 3%, and that's since the Fed went on their QE2 spree. Inventories are still very high. New housing starts have dropped. Mortgages are higher than they were for the last number of months, if not a year. And this is all, by the way, since the QE2 was initiated in order to, quote, help housing, right? Heal the housing market. Not working. Hello, knock, knock. Not working, Mr. Bernanke. You were supposed to bring down rates and you were supposed to heal the, bringing down rates would heal the housing situation and help unemployment. Sorry, but that is not what actually occurred. So we think there's a little bit of a different playbook going on there, and that's something we wrote about actually at length. We'll just say that it's a new tool that the Fed has in their toolbox called misdirection. You think about what happened. We talked about this before in benefiting the banks with a steeper yield curve. That's something we put a lot of effort into putting down and kind of trying to do some, I guess, forensic accounting on the QE2. Number seven, but the government budget deficits. When does it end? Clearly, the Republicans have not up until very recently been flexing their muscle. Right now, they came out with a ultimatum, it seems, for the states that says, you know what? You want to be bad boys and girls in the states? You want to spend money recklessly? We're not going to be behind you. We're not going to actually, you know, put up with this. We're not looking for any more government subsidies or bailouts. Don't bother coming to us with your hat in your hand. Now, I don't know how long that's going to last and how long they'll let the, you know, the states suffer. But the spend first, ask questions later attitude of the state and the federal government, really, it has to end. The U.S. sovereign debt rating is in focus. I mean, we've been told this by the S&P and other rating agencies that, you know, if we don't clean up our act and cut down our deficit, you know, don't forget that our national debt outstanding is the highest it's ever been in history. It's grown by $557 billion since August. $557 billion. And of course, the municipal bond and municipal government deficits and potential bankruptcies that Meredith Whitney has been talking about and a few others is really something that's going to be cropping its head up, just like the European situation throughout the year. Up again, down again, up again, down again. We have the tablet wars, clearly the new frontier with Apple, RIM, Google, and Microsoft. And the big question is how that OS will change our lives, not only from an aspect of business or personal fun and relaxation, but also what does that mean for other companies that will be coming out? For example, will Zynga, they make a lot of games like Mafia Wars and poker and a few other things for Facebook and Farmville and a couple of others. But, you know, they're going to come public, and what does that mean? Is that going to be a great opportunity? We got to watch these companies very carefully. And finally, number nine, Asia. The continuation of the North and South Korean tensions, and that's something that's going, again, to be on again, off again. And now we have a situation brewing where China's getting involved, and now the USA is all aggravated because we don't want them involved in North Korea, even to try to pacify the situation, it seems. We have the Chinese rate tightening, of course, Indian rate tightening. We have a major deflationary problem that just won't go away in Japan. And they're getting to be on the verge of record amounts of debt outstanding and questions about how they're going to repay it. Don't forget that the U.S. dollar, the U.S. bond, Japanese dollar, Japanese bond, are usually the refuge in troubling times. And what has happened is it's allowed those countries to be in the position to keep on issuing debt at a reckless pace. And when in the end we see what kind of amounts have built up in terms of the levels of debt, you have to say that, you know, someday, some way, somebody's going to come up and say, you know what, we're not buying your debt anymore. Now, of course, China, everybody's all concerned about China. They really don't have the option right now. They're so tied up in it. But we see that they have slowed down in the buying of new debt. They're not really necessarily selling our debt off, but they're slowing down dramatically in the buying of new debt. And that's a problem. And that's obviously helping to fuel the rally in yields, not in the price, but in yields. And that's why since, I guess, about October, September, October, the long bond has sold off by about, I think, close to 10%. Take a look at the action in TLT and you'll see what I mean. The ETF TLT kind of shows it pretty well. So those are the themes that we're really paying attention to this year and the things that we want to, well, at least right now from this aspect of this year. And those are the things that we really want to focus on. We still have a lot of opportunity, it seems to us, in many areas, and clearly in the technology area. The adoption of the smartphone is just something that right now and ongoing, when you have backbone and internet bandwidth requirements that are growing, you have voice over IP and you have video over IP, which is just, we talked about how the social networking is being used. I mean, this whole thing just keeps on growing and growing and growing. And it seems to us that, you know, this is going to be a major issue moving into 2011 and beyond. And of course, we can't end the issue discussion without a discussion about the dollar and what's happening there. And then, of course, we have to then couple that with what's happening with commodities. clearly we're seeing the opportunity for oil to surpass 100 by the summer, if not sooner. If not sooner, it could happen next week, the way things are going with oil. We have the fact that many commodity prices are just through the roof and, of course, affecting input costs around the world. And the real tragedy of it all is that food prices are up at such levels that the poorest countries around the world are continuing to have major problems when it comes to the ability to feed their people or the people to buy their food. It's a very sad circumstance that we saw happening. It's the gluttony of the countries that need because of their size and of the wealth countries and the wealthy countries of what they consume and the lack of ability for other countries that are much poorer to get their hands on what they need at a reasonable price because the rest of us are running up the prices. But anyway, we digress on that. You know what I thought we'd do? Let's get to our guest. Let's get to Tim Seymour again. And I think that probably this is a great time to segue into it because we're talking about the whole idea of poorer nations, emerging markets, et cetera. And this is the guy that I go to and listen to for emerging markets. So stick around. We'll be right back. Again, ask Andrew at The Disciplined Investor with your name, your phone number, and your question for the call-in show, which is going to be happening in about 4 weeks from now. All right, we'll be right back on The Disciplined Investor Podcast. Don't go anywhere. So I thought it would be a great idea to bring on Tim Seymour, who, if you follow him, it's emergingmoney.com, or you see him on Fast Money in the evenings. A lot of times he does a great show by himself. I think it's called Trading the Globe, right, Tim? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, that's our show where we're focusing on emerging markets and where I can really drill down for the audience and try to give people the navigation skills and, you know, the ideas to get through emerging markets. So definitely check it out on CNBC.
Yeah, so here's the deal. So he also runs a hedge fund. So this is not just theory. This is not newsletter stuff. He has a hedge fund that focuses on the emerging markets. I wanted to ask him questions because who else would I ask about some of the things that are going on around the world, right? So we have right now, Tim, we have inflation worries, which are really big concerns in places like India. And of course, we just saw a print of a 9.8% GDP in China. Now that's freaking out people that they're going to raise rates. Is this an issue that we need to be aware of that as investors, or should we shy away from EM and to some degree? Give me the lowdown.
Well, it's a big issue. Inflation for the emerging economies is fundamentally a big thing because, one, socially, inflation is, it's not palatable for you and me in the United States. It's even more unpalatable for the guy in India or China, mm-hmm. mostly because their fixed cost of living is something that really can't fluctuate much. And from a poverty perspective, that's where social problems have emerging market governments up at night. So, the other part of all this is that in the case of just about everyone other than a Russia, a Brazil, and some parts of other Latin American countries, and even some Southeast Asia, these economies are really the biggest importers of energy and resources. So most of the biggest emerging economies are net importers, and the import inflation via commodity prices, which we can all see are going through the roof right now. India is top of the list. China is not far behind, not because China doesn't have their own commodities, but as we all know, they're consuming more than they can handle. Turkey is another great example of a place that imports a tremendous amount of inflation from oil, from bulks, from softs. So it's something we should all be watching. So yeah, it's a big issue. Is this a bubble time? Is this on the precipice of a big pullback because inflation is front and center? No. In fact, I think what you're seeing is a much more proactive approach towards monetary policy in places like India. Even today, you had Brazil raise rates actually last night, 50 bips. I think the market was expecting it. I think they've articulated other ways in which they're hoping to put the brakes on inflation and try to fight what's been just a tremendous run in their currency. And this is this is the other thing that has these guys up at night. The move in the emerging market currencies is something that, while has been fantastic, and on some level should be sterilizing inflation, is something that's making a lot of these economies less competitive than they were last year.
Right, and here's the problem. And I just wrote about this. I'm a little bit late on my quarterly. We talked about the fact that the emerging markets, particularly the commodity rich or the commodity consumers, but the commodity rich, like a Brazil, for example, so they have inflation due to the fact for a lot of different reasons. One is that there's a lot of consumption going on by the middle class and the growing, et cetera, et cetera. They have obviously inflation that was put upon them by the United States, by us devaluing our currency and by thereby increasing commodity price, et cetera. So there's a good and a bad there. There's a trade-off. But on top of that, when you look at all that, they're raising rates. And what's happening there is that then other people, like you and I, let's say, will want to invest in those areas because it's a much greater return on investment. And you add that all up, that kind of keeps on the whole inflation treadmill going, right?
Well, if you look at the yield compression around the world, especially in developed, that's right. You look at real rates in Brazil. So overnight and short-term rates are around 12%. When you look at inflation around, call it 6, and you still have real rates of 6. You don't have real rates of 6 anywhere that you can in the horizon of developed worlds and even in most emerging countries. So Brazil's a place that's fought these capital flows. They continue to fight them. And what I would say about Brazil, they've got two problems. One, they're running a bigger current account deficit than they've run. And again, this comes from a consumption story at home, which is a fantastic story, and a place where they are exporting less because of a less competitive environment. They're still exporting an enormous amount. They're still a very competitive economy, but this is part of what they're concerned about. The other thing is, if you look at Brazil, inflation is really taking its form in the place where, if you're the Fed, this is really your biggest nightmare. You're actually seeing inflation in the labor force. There's not enough skilled labor. You can imagine the boom that's going on the ground, whether it's highly skilled labor or whether it's even in some of the more pedestrian occupations. It's getting very tough to find quality labor, and that's being passed on in prices as well. So that's the good and the bad of the story down there. This is a domestic economy that does not have to rely on exports. In fact, most people don't know that 65-70% of Brazilian GDP is domestic economy generated. So this is a place that's self-sustaining, kind of like an Indonesia, unlike a Russia, and where China would like to be as well. So it's an interesting story. These are challenging times, and I think from the stock market's perspective, and again, we're very active investing on the ground in Brazil. And the places that I like tend to be more of the infrastructure plays. The places that look a little challenging right now in a rising rate environment are the banks. But I would say don't sell the banks too short. These are some of the best banks in the world: Banco Itaú, Banco Bradesco. These are places that are world class banks that actually are lending and taking in savings, especially as rates go up. You can imagine that becomes a possibly more interesting environment.
Right. The problem for the average guy, though, is you're going to go out and you're going to buy the EWZ, for example, which is the ETF that has Brazil, and an inordinate amount of that is actually Petrobras, right? I mean, because that's a big part of the market.
Petrobras and Vale. Those are the two biggest weightings in the EWZ. And I would just caution people to be too reliant on ETFs, period. I think you have both technical aspects of the way ETFs trade during good times and bad that often mean you're either running at the you're running with the pack,
right?
And many times that's not exactly where you want to be. I think take a look at the EWZ, take a look at the components of it, and then break it up and start to look at some of the names in the retailing sector. CBD, which is the ticker, and this is the largest food and electronics retailer in Brazil, is a story of this is where you get a piece of the Brazilian consumer. This is where actually you've got a company that, like any retailer, whether in the United States or anywhere, is looking to increase margins, to become a more efficient order of their inventory, to run their business better, and they're doing that. And those are the kinds of names that, to me, are a little more interesting. Look, Vale is a world-class miner and probably will win the battle of who's going to soak up either Mosaic or next large potash asset. Right. Because I just think that.
But what about? Let me interrupt you. What about SQM? Why is nobody ever talking about SQM?
Socomit is a very good company, but they're in more of the higher specialty fertilizer products. They're not as much of a miner as they are someone that's a little farther out on the finish chain. The company not particularly cheap. But it's a very interesting play. I think if anything, they just did a deal in China with Magao, where they're going to be a JV on producing potassium nitrate. And I do think it's a great opportunity for them to have the distribution channel straight into China and to also begin to create some new production over there. So it's a very interesting story. It's not cheap, but it's a world-class fertilizer producer.
Right. So one of the things that really has piqued my interest this year is the whole idea of emerging market biotech. And in particular, what you mentioned before, see, as I look at maybe not so much Brazil, but somewhat Brazil and India and a couple of the countries that are in this massive middle class boom, I think they are the 1950s America. That's kind of how I look at it, right? You know, they kind of are building homes. They are getting to the next level of expansion beyond the basics, and that's what's really going. Do you follow me on that? Do you agree with that?
It's the big picture themes that make emerging markets right. So exciting, and you're nailing it. It's going from going from a two wheel bicycle in India to your first Nano, which is the cheapest car in the world, but something that actually is a major industrial step forward. It's buying that first house in middle class Brazil, which is why the Brazilian home builders have been going through the roof. So these are the things you want to look at. And as you talk about both, people spend a lot of time talking about the food chain. When you look at the move up into more refined hygiene products, over-the-counter drugs, starting to get into the pharma, that entire part of the consumer chain is not only one of the places where you're going to see the emerging governments focus a lot of their money, because that's where their biggest social safety net is put. It's the biggest cost to their economies. But obviously, it's about society. It's about improving the quality of life. And believe it or not, whether it's out of survival or out of more noble ambitions, the governments in places like India and China and Russia and some of the biggest populous nations, as well as those that are smaller, are very interested in increasing the standard of the medical and the healthcare and the farm industries. So those are exciting places to invest. They're absolutely thematically places that I don't think the trade's not over. We're very active there. And you mentioned India. There's obviously, I think people can always kind of understand and have seen India's association with technology, but also in biotech through the experience that a lot of Indian entrepreneurs have had in Silicon Valley. The experience pull from the scientific education to the reality is that these are people that actually have always been on the cutting edge. So yeah. India is a place where we watch. In Russia is another place. There's a producer out there, Pharma Standard, which is a really interesting company that to us is consolidating both the OTC drug market. They're creating new drugs for some of the extraordinary flu season that we've seen in the last couple of years that have swept through Europe and even parts of Latin America. These are the kinds of companies that you need to find, and these are the kinds of companies that actually, that's where even if you're a value investor, you're probably going to pay up a little bit more for growth, because these are the companies that are starting to change the world.
So one of the things that really, you also mentioned this, and this is something you actually focused on without me even mentioning it to you. One of the things that seems to be happening with this 1950s revolution is that there's a lot of change to diet. There's a change to their daily living structure. You want to call it westernization or just a increase in the richness of things. And for example, in India, they have an epidemic level of insulin-dependent diabetes. 1 in 7, I believe it is, that has diabetes now in India. 250,000 amputations a year. And not trying to make any money on someone else's misery, but this seems to be a major focal point from the area of just individual ability to survive. Where do we go to pick up those kind of companies that may be really making inroads in that whole area?
Well, I think you probably want to focus on people like, Dr. Reddy's and Teva, RDY and TV. I mean, people know that these are domiciled in emerging markets, but these are world-class companies that are producing generics that are starting to fight these battles at home. And I think it's easier for your investors to look at some of the bigger, I think, more established names than, there's a handful of these companies that are trading on NASDAQ. There's a bunch of these names that are popping up in China. I am less comfortable investing in a lot of these names, because especially in the, kind of the 500 million market cap and below, I really think that most of these are companies that are either not in production, that are, it's really more about intellectual property. The corporate governance risks to me in those kinds of companies are much, much greater than in the established players in the emerging land, where they are moving on generics and they also have world-class brands. That would be my advice on that. But your point is about what's going on the food chain and the dietary improvements. It certainly leads into my endorsement that if you look at the price of corn, wheat, and soy, you're going to notice that we're within 5 to 10% of kind of what I call the blow-off top in June of 2008, when all commodities were running through the roof, as much on speculation as demand. What this is telling you is that there's this cumulative effect of what's going on in terms of the food trade. There's absolutely more people with more demand requiring higher quality food stuff. And although historically no better place than softs could you see a supply response. In other words, you see a spike in price, farmers can plant more corn. Mm-hmm. They can plant more wheat. There's always more land. Well, yeah, that's sort of true, but you know, all of the cost inputs here have changed to a point where, and I think what we've also seen is this food scarcity fear. These have become strategic assets, and so you are seeing hoarding. You are seeing protective and beggar thy neighbor type policies. When the Philippines is in the market buying rice, you know that there's an imbalance in the world.
Right.
India, you know, you mentioned has got a huge deficit in terms of their fertilizer, their potash production, their supply-demand balance. They are major buyers in the market this year, and obviously we've also read a lot about some of just the weather factors that are always an issue here. So I actually am one that believes not only in a commodity super cycle, but I believe that we're not going to see wheat prices below kind of 700 a bushel anytime soon. And again, if you go back to kind of long-term averages here, just to give your viewers' perspective, I mean, it used to be more like, $300 to $400 a bushel. So, I mean, things have changed, and I don't know that we're heading back to the old paradigm anytime soon.
Right. Well, not to mention the fact that we have Mother Nature being very uncooperative with any of this to begin with, between the floods and the fires and the things that have gone on. It's really quite remarkable. And I do agree with you that now, different than 2008, it seems more apparent, or maybe it's more pronounced, that there is the demand, because it seemed like the demand was almost created by a lot of, I don't want to call it speculators, because it's kind of a weird way of saying things, but it seems like it's more apparent and more real now.
What I would say is, like, commodities as an asset class, as an allocation, even along with FX, are places that have a very different base of investors than they've ever had, and it is a new asset class to the extent that it's becoming, and it's a more accessible asset class and an allocation for people via ETFs and even some of the smaller stocks that are geared directly into the hard commodities. But I think you are in a place where you've seen this fundamental change in those that are coming out of poverty every year in emerging. It's a staggering number, and it's an exciting thing, right? And it's good for the world. But at the end of the day, it is putting more pressure on a food balance, and the building blocks of most of the food stuff is really where you're seeing this that we've never seen before. This is a function of the emerging middle class, and if you believe like I do that we're kind of in the third inning here, I think you've got a lot left in this trade.
I hear you. Listen, thanks for joining us. Again, you could find Tim Seymour on emergingmoney.com. I encourage you to check it out. He does a lot of writing on there, et cetera, and sure, provides his wonderful insight into the emerging markets like you hear now. Also, you could find him on CNBC's Fast Money. Of course, he also runs money, so it's putting his money where his mouth is here. He has a hedge fund under Triogem. So all sorts of ways to find Tim. We'll put a link on our website to get to you. And we'll check in soon, because I'd like to kind of do a little follow-up, because I am kind of I'm in between the idea of going into EM, if you were emerging markets, into the ETFs because of the dollar issue and the currency exchange, which hits you hard. And I'd rather be right in, to a Mercado Libre or an SQM, or, we like Perigo, by the way. That's they're out of Ireland, and they actually did a deal this week, and the stock just blew up straight up. It was beautiful. But, I think that is really great, and we'll keep a watch on your ideas, and I appreciate you joining us.
Anytime, Andrew. Keep speaking the faith of emerging markets like you do, and we're always happy to join you anytime.
All right. I hear you. Listen, be well. We'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this week. A couple of things I want to mention. Don't forget about the questions. We'll remind you to also do so in the next couple of shows. But write in to ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com, your name, your phone number, and the question for the call-in show. I also want to mention that the Winning Investor's Guide to Making Money in Any Market is available at Amazon and all bookstores like Barnes & Noble around the country. Get yourself a copy. It's a good book that shares some very basic details on what is investing all about. What does this economic indicator mean? What is that ETF all about? You get a great education, understanding what's happening with regard to the real core issues. This is a book for novices. It's not a book for the more advanced. That's the disciplined investor. You can grab that also at bookstores. But the Winning Investor is a real basic. If you're just like, oh, I really want to learn about this. I really want to understand about this. Well, that's what you want this book for. You can also listen to the Winning Investor podcast available on iTunes, as well as DH Unplugged, where John Dvorak and I go at it every week. And we really dig up some very strange and interesting investment issues we talk about on a regular basis. And if you haven't listened, John is a real blast to be with. So check that out. Also available on iTunes. The Disciplined Investor, of course, here, the Winning Investor, and DH Unplugged. Otherwise, we'll see you soon. I look forward to seeing you next week. Great guest coming up. We'll also share some of your questions in the next couple of episodes and maybe even have a couple of good ideas on some stock screens or something like that we'll bring in, because it is shaping up to be a very interesting earnings season. That's all for now. See you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz. Have a great week, a profitable week. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.